We met at this exclusive club called 5 Hertford Street, which is really just a door with a number on it. You walk in, and it's this extraordinary environment of plush luxury, a place where a gentleman's club would feel like home for people who lived in grandiose, stately homes in the country for most of the weekend and then came into London to their own private dwellings of equal beauty. This is the kind of place that's meant to feel like an office but isn't an office, where people sit and chat over very expensive drinks in the most opulent surroundings and hopefully feel about as comfortable as we felt. And we got to meet the man behind so much of what's happening in the UK. We sat down at a table in a courtyard where there are a whole lot of Roman and Greek architectural details hanging on the walls. And in walked a man looking smart as could be. You could see everything about him was bespoke, very well tailored outfit altogether. And I'm not just talking about the man, I'm talking about his interests as well. Ben Goldsmith, the son of financier James Goldsmith and Lady Annabel Goldsmith. Ben has so many interests, and we got talking about so many different things. He's a real fighter for the countryside in that he cares enormously about environmental affairs. He cares about clean air. He cares about a lot of different things. He's into sustainability in a big way, which is why he founded WHEB, which is a leading European sustainability-focused investment firm. It manages approximately 500 million euros across private equity, quoted equities, and renewable energy infrastructure. And when we were sitting talking to him, he also told us, among other things, about the life cycle of eels.
So I have a day job and a handful of outside interests, and all of which are in some way connected to the environment, natural environment. So I've got an investment business which I founded with a handful of partners. In fact, my immediate partner is South African, a guy called Graham Thomas.
All right.
Who was at Standard Bank for years and was at Goldman Sachs before that, and ran the Rothschild Investment Trust here in London for a period of time. And we have a pretty flexible investment mandate in that we can invest in equities, or we can lend money to people, we can invest in funds, we can invest anywhere we want. The focus, though, is energy and resource efficiency, which is a kind of less scary way of saying green industries.
Right.
So I think of ourselves as a green fund, but green scares mainstream investors, even though the whole energy system is being overhauled globally and by the emergence of cheap green energy. Investors still find that term green, like the term ethical or impact, a little bit frightening. So really we focus on energy and resource efficiency. We invest in businesses which are, the exact wording is, either delivering or benefiting from the more efficient use of energy and water and raw materials and so on.
Big emphasis in South Africa on sustainable energy, because we've got a rubbish energy producer, Eskom. It's all sort of parastatal, and we have to put up with power cuts. And
all those old monopolies and vested interests are going to get turned over by the force of economics.
I'm very happy to hear that.
I mean, solar, the price of a solar panel. Just in the time since I started talking to Graham Thomas, we launched our business in 2015, so I started talking to him maybe a year and a half before. The price of a solar photovoltaic panel has gone from the same as a high-definition flat-screen TV to a window frame, like 90% reduction in kind of 5.5-6 years. So solar is killing everything. So that's what I do. I've got a green investment fund with a mandate that looks more like a kind of merchant bank than a normal fund, in that we can really invest in anywhere we want. We've invested in electricity transmission infrastructure in Brazil. We've invested in Volkswagen, because we feel that they will be a big, big player in the electrified transport market. They're going to be one of the biggest electric car companies in the world, and we're sensible kind of Jeffrey Boycott investors, you know, build a sensible innings, and therefore we'd rather own Volkswagen than Tesla, if you see from an investment perspective.
Right.
So that's what I do. That's my kind of day job. I'm chief executive of that firm. But I'm also pretty keen on trying to fix some of the big environmental problems we're facing, and so I'm on the board of the British government's Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, and I'm a special advisor to Michael Gove, who's the Environment Minister. And we're leaving the European Union, and that opens up a huge raft of opportunities for doing things differently, because previously about 80% of laws that we have in this country that relate to the natural environment, whether it's fisheries or agricultural subsidies or air quality rules or water quality, all the whole lot, 80% were decided in Brussels, which was really a kind of some sense has been pretty good, but in some sense has been a disaster. So there's a whole, but we'll come back to that, but there's a whole bunch of opportunities, I think, around reimagining how we manage our natural environment now that we're leaving the European Union. And there's a radical, free-thinking, highly intelligent environment minister in place at the moment. So I've got quite an exciting kind of stroke of luck in being close to him and being able to influence that. That's where I spent my day today. I've been in DEFRA all day today. And then the other non-executive interest I have is I'm a trustee for the Britain's biggest philanthropist. It's a guy called Chris Hone, H-O-H-N, who is no one's ever heard of him, which is amazing, because he's the biggest philanthropist this country has ever produced. He was born the son of a car mechanic in Montego Bay, Jamaica, and they knew they had a genius on their hands. And he made his way here, went to university in Southampton, and is a financial genius, and has created a hedge fund called the Children's Investment Fund, known in financial circles as TCI, which is, I think, Europe's biggest and most feared activist hedge fund. He runs about $30 billion for investors and takes on big companies. He's recently had a big fight with the London Stock Exchange and has a big position in Google and big position in Airbus. And he's a big, big player in financial circles. And he called it that because he always intended to give the money that he made personally to effectively tackling the biggest threats facing children in the poorest societies in the world. So he created a foundation simultaneously called the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, CIF, which receives most of the money that he makes through that hedge fund. And CIF is now the UK's second largest charity after the Wellcome Trust, with $6 billion of assets and an annual grant budget of $300 million. So he is by far and away the biggest philanthropist in proportionate and also absolute terms that this country's ever produced. No one's ever heard of him. He's just this funny, laid-back Jamaican guy who gives $300 million a year away out of this endowment. That foundation, of which I'm one of four trustees, is the biggest climate funder in Europe, because he and we have come to the conclusion that a changing climate is the biggest threat to children's well-being and health and prosperity and so on. So we fund climate initiatives around the world to the tune of about $100 million a year, all kind of campaigning and advocacy and technical assistance and kind of targeted interventions that can change things. As a hedge fund manager, he's interested in leverage. You know, a small amount of money triggers a big change. And then we spend a lot of money on child protection with a focus on India. So, you know, tens of millions of dollars a year helping to end the child trafficking, child sexual exploitation trades in India. And then thirdly, we have a program which we call Survive and Thrive. It really is about helping children and teenage girls. So reproductive health, contraception, focus on Africa, severe and acute malnutrition, worms, neglected tropical diseases, this kind of stuff. So, for example, we're currently providing the finance to treat every single child in Somalia in one day for deworming. Average donation size is kind of $17-18 million. So it's an amazing organization. So I'm close to him and I'm close to the environment minister, and I spend time with both of them, and those are kind of my extracurricular interests.
But they could have synergies, obviously, as well.
Yeah, of course. In fact, they have conflicts as well, because CIF is a funder of a group called Client Earth, which is an environmental legal advocacy group which takes people to court for doing bad things to the environment. And Client Earth is currently suing the British government's Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs over air quality. And I'm on the board of both CIF and DEFRA. So there's also conflicts as well, and it's not easy.
It's incredible.
I sort of got lucky in the last year or so in terms of these two outside interests. But I think
that's quite a lot on your plate. It's enough.
People, I always find the people who say that they're spectacularly busy are often the people who are least good at managing their time. Is that what I mean?
But if you want something done, ask a busy person.
Well, exactly. So I always feel embarrassed to say I'm busy.
Is it true that sort of the future of energy, you know, how typically the old school style was that production and consumption would happen at different places? So there was kind of the power farms that would generate the energy, and then it would be sent off to multiple different properties. Whereas now it's like decentralization, and it's going to be sort of consumption and production.
You guys must see this in Africa. Yeah, I mean, the ultimate decentralization thing, basically, because with the arrival of mobile telephones and so on, banking has become accessible to all sorts of people who didn't previously have access to communication or banking, and energy is going the same way.
Yeah.
So the distributed energy, I think, is the most exciting kind of innovation taking place. Now that, because in the old days, they would, exactly as you said, in the old days, the kind of old model is produce as much power as we might particularly need in a particular moment of peak demand.
Inefficient.
So, exactly. So we need enough baseload capacity to accommodate kind of World Cup final, everyone puts a kettle on at half time or whatever, you know, and they have a tremendous surge of power demand.
Yeah.
And that's been turned on its head by distributed generation. And I mean, so the Children's Investment Fund Foundation is trying to find a way to help countries like Mexico, which are kind of emergent economies, and South Africa. We have a program in South Africa as well, move beyond the kind of 30% renewables ambition to 100%. And you can't really go beyond 30% renewables, which are inherently intermittent. You get power from solar when the sun shines, you get power from wind when the wind shines. You can't go beyond that without a bunch of other kind of innovations. So, for example, you need to have develop
storage.
So storage is a big one, but there are easier ones than storage. So obvious ones are advanced meteorological forecasting embedded into the grid, so you know when you're going to generate surges in power and when you're not, so it allows you to react to that. Secondly, you need trans-regional sharing. So, for example, Denmark will, on days, produce way more than it needs and will export that surplus to its neighbours. And there are days when the wind's not blowing and it will import. So we should be sharing power with Portugal. You know, in a sunny August day in Portugal, they should be exporting cheap surplus solar power to us. And
this gives countries that otherwise have no real resource, like Algeria, which have kilometres and kilometres of desert, a means to turn that into something valuable.
That's fantastic. Exactly. It's exactly right. And there is a project called Desertec, which is about putting cables underneath the Mediterranean to sell cheap solar power to... But, no, I'm good. Thank you very much. But then there's also demand response. So if you integrate dynamic pricing into a grid, so that power prices go high when everyone wants power and it goes low when no one wants power, and then every home has a smart meter which reacts to pricing, you can then alter the use so that you smooth out the peaks and troughs in demand. So I mean, we're not far away from a situation in which every house has a smart meter and the smart meter tells the washing machine to get working at 3 a.m. or if you're charging your car in the garage, the smart meter will buy cheap power in the middle of the night. And Denmark has gone one stage further with that, such that workers are now supplementing their salaries by 2,000 or 3,000 euros a year by charging their car when it's cheap at night, driving to work, and then plugging it back in, and the smart meter at home is directing the car to sell 50% or 75% of the battery power back to the grid when power prices peak during the middle of the day.
Clever.
And so you, everyone,
your car becomes a stock exchange.
In effect, you create an internet of power where people are downloading and uploading all the time according to pricing and so on. And so you're supplementing people's incomes that way, but also you're dealing with the problem of storage. Rather than having to invest huge amounts of money in utility scale storage around the country, which is also happening, you just use the cars in the country as storage, and there are plenty of cars.
All right, but before we get excited about all of that, there's Donald Trump, who on two fronts must present you with problems. The first one being his seeming dislike for sustainable energy and his preference for mining and coal and oil and all the rest of it, because he's trying to protect the jobs.
Yeah.
And then the other problem is that he's a climate denier.
Yeah. I think he's worrying, but not as worrying as all that. Because if you really look at it, Donald Trump trying to save the coal industry by shoveling subsidies in their direction and possibly even legislating to ensure that utilities buy a particular proportion of their power from coal plants, it's a losing battle. It'll be expensive and it'll be a losing battle. It's kind of like trying to save Blockbuster in the face of video streaming, as Arnold Schwarzenegger pointed out in that brilliant little podcast a few days ago, or trying to save the compact disc when people started streaming music, or trying to save the rotary telephone.
Someone like Trump doesn't like more than being told that he can't.
True, but market forces are more powerful than his ability to stop them, and the fact is that every single year solar and wind in particular just get so much cheaper than everything else.
Yeah.
Plus you have all the externalized costs of coal, which no one accounts for. I mean, what's the cost of American kids getting asthma, you know, the premature deaths in American cities as a result of coal particulate pollution.
The air quality you were talking about.
The air quality, exactly. The tremendous pollution to the water courses from coal mining. I mean, the way they remove coal from mountains in Appalachia, in one of the last kind of great wildernesses of the US, the mountaintop, they dynamite off the top of the mountain, and all that spoil then spills down and floods the valley and destroys the valley, and then they dig out the coal and they leave an obliterated landscape. So those externalities are huge, and they're not accounted for properly. So I feel that even without the externalized cost, coal is simply not economic anymore. It's a dying industry, and you can't pick it up. And the second reason why I'm not as concerned about Trump as others is that a lot of the action on climate is happening at the state and at the regional level, and sometimes it takes a great big bad guy from a Disney movie to motivate everyone else to be the good guy, and he is the Disney movie bad guy. And as a result, you've got city mayors joining hands and saying, our city, forget what Trump says, our city is going for net zero. California is aiming for net zero. You know, states are clubbing together and agreeing ways in which they can phase out and move beyond coal. So I feel like state and city legislators and regional legislators are stepping up their game in response to Trump going the opposite direction. There's an amazing movement called the Green Tea Party. Have you seen that?
No.
It's founded by a lady called Debbie Dooley, who was the coordinator or president of the Atlanta, Georgia chapter of the Tea Party movement. And meanwhile, back at home, Debbie wanted to put solar panels on her roof, and she discovered that the utilities were lobbying the state legislature in Georgia to put a tax on solar on people's roofs on the basis that it wasn't fair on the big utility producers if suddenly demand for their services would fall through the floor because of home solar. And she, of course, through her kind of small-c conservative free market libertarian instincts, which is what the Tea Party's about, decided that, who is the state government to intervene in my ability, to my right to collect sunshine on my roof to power my house? So she teamed up with the left-leaning Sierra Club of Georgia, which is the environmental group, one of the big environmental groups in Georgia, and arm in arm, the Tea Party movement, the Green Tea Party movement, which was founded, and the Sierra Club successfully fought the legislature. And now you have these kind of pan left right political alliances fighting against vested interests. So it's I feel that Trump will only be able to go so far in slowing down the rise of renewables and the move to a...
I'm only being devil's advocate because I think I agree with you on all fronts. I also think that in our particular circumstances in South Africa, we have this really inefficient energy producer.
Yeah.
And we have huge amounts of solar energy we can reap. We've got the natural resources in terms of coal, but it's just not sustainable. It's becoming more expensive to extract. Yeah. There are so many middlemen between the power producer and the coal miner, and it's not reliable.
Yeah.
It's been managed bad.
I mean, are we reaching a stage where solar, I think, can become like kind of... can become like mobile data. It can become virtually ubiquitous. I mean, I think we're going to reach a stage where buildings are made of solar stuff and roads. And
yeah.
The first solar road opened in France recently.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And there are buildings now, when I drive my kids to school, there are buildings in London where the whole side of the building is solar. And the panels are just becoming so cheap. And they've invented things, kind of tiles which look like solar. Windows, pricing is not there yet, but windows that you see through like it's a normal window, but it's generating power. So I think solar will displace everything, almost everything else. And wind as well is becoming incredibly cheap.
What about batteries? Because we talked about storage earlier.
Well, they're following a similar price trajectory.
Are they?
Yeah, so they are. But there are issues there with mining out the material as expensive and dirty business. And
lithium.
Lithium and yeah.
Mostly South America?
I think Africa, no. I was asked to invest in a lithium mine in somewhere in Central Africa. But I think storage plays a role, for sure. My neighbour in Somerset, I have a farm 100 miles west of here, where I spend...
I'm from Somerset.
Are you?
Yeah.
I'm near Bruton.
I'm Long Ashton, but so I'm near Somerset.
Yeah, yeah. So I spend every kind of free day there. So I go Friday morning if I can, or Friday night, and come back Monday and have a little farm there and so on. And my neighbour there is quite kind of head of the curve, forward thinking guy, and he's got a Tesla battery which is huge. It looks like a huge kind of iPod.
Yeah.
And there is a remote sort of office somewhere that manages these batteries that certain people have installed, to the extent that they're trading power, just like those Danish car owners, but on a bigger scale. So we already have some semblance of dynamic pricing here, and it's becoming kind of more sophisticated over time. But they're powering up certain times of day and powering down at other times of day and trading in order to make a return. So that's and you get, if you're a battery or you're a gas-fired power unit of the size of this building, so a miniature one in a car park somewhere, you get what's called a capacity payment just for existing. So I have another friend who's Venezuelan, who's invested a huge amount of money in short-term gas kind of turbines, like the size of this room, parked in the back of a Sainsbury's car park or whatever. And it might only operate for 40 hours a year or whatever, but you could turn it on like that remotely, and just having that backup capacity gives the grid kind of reassurance, and the grid will pay you huge amounts of money just to exist. And so he would argue that whilst he's a fossil fuel business, he's an enabler of a renewables. But I think what's much more exciting, and it's not a business, but from South Africa is a huge conservation nation. I think what's much more exciting is the conservation stuff, because I think that there's an awakening in this country that we've lost a lot. I mean, the equivalent of the Big Five or the Big Eight or whatever you see in South Africa has all been killed here. So we've lost in this country, from the biggest to the smallest, moose, bears, bisons, aurochs, which is an ancestor of the modern cow, wild boar, beavers, white-tailed eagles, wolves, lynx, white storks, great bustards, pelicans. Remember pelicans up and down the south coast of England as recently as 700 years ago? The last wolf was killed in Stirling in 1788. We've completely extirpated our wildlife in this country in a way that no other country has achieved. And we've extirpated whole landscapes from nature and brainwashed the population to believe it's wild and beautiful. So you think of the Highlands of Scotland, for example, picture postcard. The Highlands of Scotland are the most ecologically denuded landscapes on Earth. Perhaps with the exception of the Arabian Peninsula, which would have been more of a savanna historically, it's been completely extirpated. Even 300 years ago, after a lot of the charismatic megafauna have gone, you still had a mosaic landscape of kind of trees and clearings and glades and flowers.
So all of that heather and heath is nonsense.
It's sheep. It's a monoculture of sheep. It's one of the most intensively managed landscapes on Earth, to the extent that it's completely unable to fulfill its natural function, and that is as water towers. Ask the Ministry of Environment from Uganda or Costa Rica or Pakistan or Nepal or anywhere that has hills, how do you prevent floods and how do you reduce droughts? It's make sure that your hills and your mountains can fulfill the function for which they were designed, which is to be water towers. In other words, a healthy functioning ecosystem in the hills, trees, plants, wildlife, so on, can absorb water when it rains and release it slowly throughout the year. That's what they do. If you remove all the nature, then it rains and you get soil erosion, you get landslips, and you get flooding. And that's why when we get flooding here every couple of years, it's headline news, people's living rooms are full of mud and water, and people drown and cars get washed away. And it's always in the same places. It's in and around the kind of immediate vicinity of our uplands. It's kind of Cumbria and Northumberland, the borders of Scotland, it's around Dartmoor and Exmoor in the south. And no one ever points the finger at the fact that we've got completely denuded hills. And yet people go there on holiday in the Lake District and they take a picture and put it on Instagram, and I can see a long way, so it must be, I've got no mobile reception, it must be beautiful, it must be wild. Reality is they're blank canvases, which is the glass half full way of looking at it. They're blank canvases, and the reason why they're like that is principally because we provide subsidies to an industry which makes no economic sense whatsoever, which is intensive sheep farming. So we have just by way of illustrating how uneconomic it is, we have 1.5 million hectares of productive lowland agricultural land in Great Britain. We have nearly three times as much uplands. So we have about 4 million hectares of upland landscapes. So nearly three times as much. The 1.5 million hectares of lowland agricultural land produces 99% of the food we produce. The uplands, nearly three times bigger, produce 1%. In other words, this is like Marie Antoinette's model peasant village. Marie Antoinette famously used to like dressing up as a peasant and pretending to farm potatoes, and look how charming it all is. That's what we have in the uplands. We provide a huge amount, several billion pounds a year.
For show.
So basically for show. There are elements of preserving community integrity, and there are arguments to all that. There's British literary romance around kind of the uplands, Wordsworth, Beatrix Potter, the sheep, Austin. The kind of bleak. Huh. When I think of the British uplands, I think of Myra Hindley and Ian Brady and those mass murders where they were hunting for the have you seen those images? You know when they do this? Have you ever seen those images?
Yes, the boys. Yeah.
It's the helicopters looking at the search parties, looking for the children. And all you see is just brown nothingness as far as the eye can see. And if you look at the moors around Manchester right now, Saddleworth Moor, you've got some of the biggest wildfires we've ever experienced, because we've drained the moors. There's no water up there at all. So it takes no time for them to dry out, whereas they should be soaked landscapes with beavers creating pools and wetlands and glades of trees, and it's very difficult to burn an English woodland. If you want to burn an English woodland, you have to cut the tree down and dry it out for 6 months. It's very difficult. So you clear everything, And then you have these tinderbox conditions, and now we have these enormous fires. You can't open your windows in Manchester right now. You know, there's, you know, 500 firefighters fighting against massive fires. You've seen it in the news. So this is the great opportunity, because we have an environment minister who I advise, who has stated that the agriculture bill, the first since 1947, which will come before Parliament next month, this month, July, will provide for the switching of all agricultural subsidy away from a model where we just give it to you because you're a farmer, to a model of public money for public good. So if you're doing something which is defined as public good, and there'll be a list of what is defined as public good, we'll give you money. If you're not, then you're not. So farmers effectively will have two income streams. They'll have the money they get from selling food and have the money they get from selling environmental services. Great. In the form of public good. And so if you're an upland farmer, you'll be helping reduce flooding by putting vegetation in parts of the upland.
Do you think
allowing
people
a bit
plant
of
trees and stuff?
Well, you don't really need to spend a huge amount of money planting trees. All you've got to do is reduce grazing pressure and they'll come back. You know, forests regenerate in most places pretty easily. You can accelerate the process with a bit of planting. But tree regeneration and to the extent there is agricultural production in the uplands, you know, in my view, it should be an incidental to environmental land management. So, for example, what you don't want is Brazilian-style tree-to-tree forest. It would never have been that way. You'd have had grazing animals and so on. So you want extensive cattle, for example. You know, you want, that's what they had up there until the Highland clearances of the 1780s and 90s, when they cleared people to put sheep. They quadrupled the rents overnight. It was a refugee. There were refugees, the Highlanders. They then put sheep there, and now of course that's ancient history, is our great kind of sheep history. It's about 200 years at most. It used to be extensive.
Was that
capital
to punish the Jacobites?
No. It was the Duke of Sutherland cashing in on a demand for wool. And the Duke of Sutherland in the Highlands and in other places, they cleared the people by quadrupling the rent, brought in a shitload of sheep, and then in England, that persists in the form of this grotesquely uneconomic industry which is propped up by taxpayer money. And in Scotland, the sheep died out, but they switched to a kind of Victoria and Albert kind of ersatz sort of deer stalking. So you know, let's all put a hat that looks like Sherlock Holmes. Let's wear tartan.
That's the wilderness.
You know, this is how Scotland is, and it's not. It's invented by Albert, who was German, and Victoria, who was English, and people fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. And now you have these. If you go through the Highlands on those kind of dual carriageway roads, there were never trees here. It, the strip of land between the two carriageways of the road is full of flowers and trees. Or you look at the lochs from the air, Google Earth, you'll see an island in the middle of a Scottish loch, and it's full of life, with like trees and flowers and God knows what else. And then it's just desert in all directions for 500 miles in every direction. And you'll see these deer, mangy deer, milling about, because it's about 20 times the carrying capacity. So they feed them in the winter, and then they've got this deer stalking industry where you go up there, some, you know, kind of, it's basically can, it's like shooting cows in Hyde Park. It's like can shooting. There's no cover. They come to their feeding stations, boom, they get shot. You know, it's like those guys who shoot lions inside of cages in South Africa. So that's all going to change, in my view. You know, through enlightened land ownership and reforming agricultural subsidy. Well, there's a bill coming before Parliament, the Agriculture Bill, which will say that from now on public money needs to be handed out in exchange for public good. There's no guarantee that Scotland will follow, by the way. They're independent, but the evidence suggests that they will. But bear in mind, that will also be great news for the Lowlands as well, because whilst we still want to farm productively in the Lowlands, we've got 60 million people to feed or whatever it is, we want to produce food, and we want to do so in a way that doesn't poison the water and doesn't lose the soil. We're losing 1.5% of our soil is lost average every year. If you look at Great Britain from the air, there's a brown skid mark. You know, it looks like, you know, my kind of 18 months old diaper. You know, it's like a skid mark. Or you
all
go
around the coast,
or go and stand on Blackpool Pier, or you mean to Blackpool or Brighton or anywhere, the water's brown, right? Okay, the water was not brown. The water was blue. The reason why the water's brown, that's our soil. That's how we feed ourselves. And yet we farm intensively. There's no thought to kind of, you know, all you do is plough sideways along the contour. If you plough upwards, the soil runs off when it rains. Now, there's all sorts of ways that you can continue to farm productively whilst protecting your soil, whilst storing carbon, whilst not spraying kind of nerve gas all over the, you know, new technology around satellites and drones and big data.
Do Londoners care as much? I mean, I can hear how much work you've done here and how much you've thought about this and how much reading you must have done, and how many people you've spoken to. Do Londoners care enough?
So as a nation, we're wildlife lovers. You know, the David Attenborough show at Blue Planet was the most watched television program ever.
Yeah.
Ever. And certainly the most watched last year. I mean, you know, a third of the population watched it. As a nation, 8 to 10 million people give money annually to an environmental organisation. You know, we feed the birds. You know, every British family has a bird feeder in their garden. You know, we love hedgehogs. We care about wildlife. You know, so overwhelmingly, Britons want to see a natural or kind of environmental renaissance in their country. And people are starting to notice that wildlife is depleted. You know, if you take a drive when you were a cat, how old are you?
40.
So when we were all kids, you go driving somewhere in the summer in your parents' car, and you have to stop because the windscreen was covered in insects in the summer.
Yeah.
You know, I can drive to Somerset, there's no insects on my windscreen. Now, there's been a collapse in insect numbers, there's been a collapse in bird numbers, there's been a collapse in all sorts of things. You know, the rivers, even when we were children, I was a child, not that I saw it myself, the autumn equinox, most rivers in England were black with eels, literally black with eels. There's been a 95% decline in eels in my lifetime. You know, it's all disappearing because of 95% decline in European eels. Do you know how the eel's life cycle?
Yeah.
The most interesting of all the animals that live in this country
Tell
is
me.
The humble eel. So the eel will, is it kind of omnivore, will eat anything, will live in a patch of water. So it could be in an estuary, it could be in a river, they can move across at night time when the ground is wet, they can move to a pond, it might even be in a well. And an eel will live for 20-ish years, 25 years, in a body of water, quite territorial, and it will live there. You can have one in your pond in your local park.
Yeah.
At a particular moment in advance of the autumn equinox, when there's no moon at night, they'll turn blue. Over a period of like 2 weeks, a black eel, aged 20, 25 years old, male or female, will turn a brilliant, brilliant blue. Like, as in the colour of like the Caribbean Sea, will turn blue. And it will then travel on moonless nights to find the nearest watercourse. It will then swim down the stream, down into the river, out the estuary, and will spend 3 to 6 months swimming across the Atlantic to a particular spot, 40 square miles, just off Bermuda, called the Sargasso Sea, where it will congregate with eels, amazingly, from America and from the whole of Western Europe. And one of the great natural wonders of the world that's never been witnessed is they go down about a mile into the inky blackness, and they'll form an enormous mating ball, like millions, and in the old days, billions of eels, on a particular moment each year, and they don't know when and at what time or where. All we know is that eels go there to mate and die. And if you catch an eel on its way in the river, it's brilliant blue. And they're black, but they turn brilliant sky blue. They then breed, okay, down there. Then the little elvers go up, and amazingly, the American ones know, because they're genetically different, to go west, and the European ones come east. They then spend 3 years swimming back to Europe, and when they're born, they're that big. By the time they arrive, they're called elvers. They're a Japanese delicacy. And they get washed up into the rivers from kind of Iceland, Scotland, all the way down to Spain. Some of them will go up the English Channel and end up in Denmark, and they get scarcer and scarcer the further east you go. Some make it into the Mediterranean, up into the Spanish rivers, and then they swim up the rivers, and then they go and find themselves a pond, and they live there for 20 years. And the problem is that that's such a complicated life cycle that as soon as you start building weirs and dams and making their passage difficult, and as soon as you start netting them, so now the illegal poachers will sit at the river mouths when the elvers come in, which is kind of spring equinox time every year, they come in on the waves, they will just sit there with nets and catch them by the billion and then send them to Japan, and the population has plunged 95% in 30 years. So the eel was once so numerous that in the eastern US they reckon that 40% of all freshwater fish biomass was eels. That's out of all the fish in the east coast, 40% were eels, and now it's down by none. And President Macron of France has announced a liberation of the rivers, and they're smashing up and breaking down all the kind of pre-war and post-war kind of infrastructure, the weirs, the little dams, well, smashing it all up to allow the eels to come back. And it's got like a kind of anti-poaching squad, you know, from kind of, you know. So there's a book called
The Eel Force.
Yeah, The Eel Force. So I think we're going through, I think with Macron in charge of France and with a kind of awakening here, I think we're going through quite an exciting time for the environment. And I think the shifting of agricultural subsidy is the biggie.
It's actually Brexit.
I don't think it's anything to do with that. It's certainly, whether you hate or love Brexit, it's a big positive. The fact that we're going to move to a model of public subsidy for public good in the countryside, you know, £3 to £4 billion a year, directly incentivizing land managers to do the right thing, you know, you're suddenly going to see a change. Within 3 years, 2 years, 3 years, you'll look out of your car window and you'll see flower-rich borders around fields. You'll see new ponds appear. You'll see people restoring their hedgerows. You'll see new trees getting planted. You'll see the river quality clearing up. All that stuff is going to happen, and we're the first country in the world to design a system like that. You know, and in the uplands, it'll be even more dramatic.
Yeah.
because there's just no money in sheep at that place. No, without environmental land management payments, there's nothing.
So I was tipped off to ask you about legalising marijuana.
Yeah, of course we should. It's absurd. I think it's completely absurd. Don't you?
Absolutely.
I mean, I think... apart from
in South Africa, there are peasant farmers who are... The police come in and they actually burn down their crops. And they're cash crops for them. And they're not selling them to children on street corners. They're going into the community and saying, here is some of this that I've grown, and getting a very reasonable price for it. And it's being shut down by government.
Yeah, what about in St. Vincent and the Grenadines? The Drug Enforcement Agency, not that long ago, flew with aeroplanes over crop dusters and sprayed Monsanto's Roundup, which is a herbicide, over smallholders in St. Vincent.
Jesus.
No checking whether the kids are playing in the field. No checking what they're growing there. You know, St. Vincent's a really poor country. They're growing their own crops.
They'll have mixed crops, won't they?
Mixed crops and some weed and so on. And imagine the arrogance of doing that in another country. So, but I think that, A, it's just patently absurd to tell me what I can't smoke and what I can smoke. And what, you know, I don't believe that government... It's a major overreach by government. In the first case, I don't think that's the role of government, to police our daily habits. The government can get fucked. But secondly, I also think it doesn't work. Let's just say we hate marijuana, and we think it's the devil's kind of, you know, devil's substance, and it's going to send all our children crazy, and we hate it. Well, even so, banning it is not the answer, because use just goes up. All drugs, use just goes up. Every single...
Deteriorates the issue.
No,
we got natural products.
You've got to legalise, you've got to regulate.
And this, negative,
and then there are tax benefits.
And exactly. And what was it? The mayor of Seattle said the big winners of legalisation in Washington State have been the police, because they no longer have to police marijuana, and the taxpayer, because we're getting a whole chunk of cash every quarter. The big losers are the drug traffickers and the drug dealers on street corners, because they've had their business pulled out from underneath them. And that makes sure. But the worst kind of output from prohibition of marijuana is that, you know, kind of the kids in my family, you know, they smoke skunk, which is a kind of ultra strong moonshine, chemically artificially grown form of marijuana, because it's all they can get their hands on. It's the same way that in the prohibition of alcohol in the United States, people drank moonshine, because you no point transporting Lafitte 1941 or whatever,
crazy,
you know, or beer,
cheap, nastily made stuff,
cheap, strong, concentrated, and skunk is like cheap. They grow it in slave houses. They got slaves from Vietnam or wherever, you know, people trafficking people, and put them in these houses and grow them under artificial lights and stuff it with fertilizers, and then sell it on street corners. And that's what kids smoke. And that really does have a problem with people's, you know, makes you go mad.
Yeah.
Then, you know, if it was legal, they'd be buying, you know, nice Jamaican weed or nice Moroccan hash. And it would be legal, and it would be regulated, and kids wouldn't be able
but
to buy
think,
it.
But I don't think any drugs should be illegal.
It'll happen, by the way. You've seen all the furore around medical marijuana in the last 2 weeks here. Have you seen it? A kid with epilepsy, up to 200 fits a day. The only thing that worked was cannabis-based treatment. The mother couldn't get it because it was illegal. So she went out abroad, bought it, declared it, came in, and they tried to arrest her and take it off her. And they succeeded. The kid then's in hospital having 15 fits an hour, and the Home Secretary intervened and said, right, she can have the drug she wants. And I'm announcing a review on the laws around medical cannabis. And it's happening. And once you legalize medical cannabis, recreational follows very quickly, because then you say, oh, I'm anxious, you know, I can't sleep at night.
Yeah, once it becomes a grey area. Right.
Well, wait, if I... Yeah. So I mean, that's what happens in, you know, you then get, you know. So I think it'll happen. If I wrote a list 15 years ago of all the things I wanted to happen in this country, it feels like they're all happening.
Good.
There's lots of bad things as well.
It's quite positive.
On the environment, it's all good news. Banning of plastics. And
so what's bad?
Plastic things, amazing.
What do you... Yeah, we spoke about this just on the way here, actually. And Eleanor was saying how it irritates her that there are people who just don't see the value of recycling, you know, of separating rubbish, and how in certain places where the rules are strict, people are happy to comply and they feel like they're making a contribution.
And it's all going to change.
Only really dreadful people don't care about that stuff.
I know, but I think you still need sticks and carrots from government. So, for example, you need, in my view, you need a tax on virgin plastic. If you're Coca-Cola,
In a brand new bottle.
And you find that virgin plastic is actually more expensive than recycled plastic because of a tax. You're going to use the recycled stuff.
Yep.
So that encourages recycling and puts more of a value on material collection and so on. And I think you just need a ban on single-use stuff. I mean, a single-use straw or single-use plastic knives and forks. And all those things are banned in France now. You know, you need to ban them. You need to ban plastic bags. I think it's all going to happen.
A significant mind shift that needs to happen, right? So now I'm, you know, whenever I go out and I'm offered a straw, I'm rejecting straws, and people just look at what?
Yeah.
Or if I'm being super efficient, I actually have my own paper straws.
Mm.
Which is also that's goes down. People just think that's
very industrious
of you.
Well, they're like,
yeah, thank you,
you
have your own paper straws.
Well, I'm trying to.
What's interesting is tourism, like the kind of millennial generation, the kind of under 35s, they don't want to do the same tourism that their parents did. They don't want to go to a 1,000-room hotel in Costa del Sol and sit on a beach and go to the bar and then go back to their room. They want to go to a 6-bedroom boutique somewhere in Florence, or they want to go and stay in a farmhouse bed and breakfast somewhere in kind of Chiantishire or whatever. They want experiences, and they want to go to different kinds of places. They want to go to those big corporate places anymore, and they've got a sort of consciousness around environmental and kind of cultural appropriateness now. And so it's really changing. I think there's like social media has kind of unlocked this kind of.
I think it's very true in our generation.
Yeah.
Massively. We were just on this boat last week, and obviously all the water that you can drink is a bottled water, but we were all debating it. We were saying, gosh, look at how much water how much plastic we're wasting.
I know.
We were saying to the staff, we were like, please can we make sure this is recycled, because it's just so awful.
Exactly. No one would have thought about that 15 years
and
ago.
And yet, we were like, God, are we just a very conscious group, or is this,
No, I had the same. Just like, I was just on holiday in Greece, and the tap water. Tap water is non-drinkable. And staying with a friend of mine there, and we must have drunk through 80 bottles of plastic water. I wrote to the company that organised the villa for my friend, and I said we had such a lovely time. But bottled water is such a crime, and surely you can put dispensers. My mother has a dispenser,
a big tank or something.
It's a dispenser. There's bottles that the office bottles.
Yeah, the bubble.
Or filter on the tap.
What's you did say just now that all the things that you wished for 30 years ago are starting to happen, but you said that there were some things that are not happening or that are worse that you're worried about. What are those?
I mean, I think the indicators are all, looking at the natural environment, the indicators are all continually downwards, so we haven't yet figured it out. It's just think in a policy sense things are changing, and in a kind of social awareness sense things are changing, and those are the ingredients you need to kind of slow down and reverse the trends. But still, every year there are fewer swifts returning from Africa and flying above our heads screeching, and there are fewer amphibians returning to each pond and breeding, and nature is under assault, and those indicators just continue to get worse and worse. So I feel like we kind of know what needs to be done now, and there's a willingness to do it, and it's all kind of starting to happen. But the question is, will we do it fast enough, or will it be too late? Because I think there are tipping points that we're not fully aware of, and I think if you go too far, things collapse. And like the greatest fishery of kind of the world ever was the cod fishery of the Grand Banks of Canada, and they just decimated it in the late 90s. Ramped up production and put boats out that were like the size of ferries and just basically hoovered up all the cod, and one day there was no more cod and they've never come back ever. They just took too many and they couldn't. So I think things can disappear, and then becomes impossible to rebuild them. So the question is how quickly we can turn it round. And I think nature is the issue. I think it's like everyone talks about climate, and it's all linked, obviously. And climate is the great crisis of our time, but also the destruction of nature. Kind of burning the library of life. I feel like a lot of the kind of answers are starting to kind of come to the fore. So who knows?
It's good work. It's important work.
Yeah.
I'm very pleased to hear that some of these things are turning around here. And although we have such an abundance of natural wildlife and fauna and flora and all the rest of it in South Africa, we've sort of put that on the back burner. I interviewed a guy just 3 weeks ago. He's written a book about the history of our big nature reserves.
Very good.
Yeah, and he was talking about how a lot of that stuff has been neglected in recent years. So we almost need to start doing what you're doing here before it's too late, as it became here.
Although you do have national, we have no national parks at the moment.
None.
So, in the sense that our national parks are not national parks in the sense that any other country would recognise them. In the sense that our national, the emblem of the Yorkshire Dales National Park is sheep, and there is actually less. There is less diversity and abundance of wildlife in our national parks than there is outside.
God.
So if you go to Dartmoor, look up on your phone later a picture of Dartmoor or the North Yorkshire Moors or any of these places, and like I said, it's just a monoculture of heather. And heather or short grass, because heather is a pioneer plant. If you scorch the land, the first thing that pioneers the space is heather. And so it's like an incredibly important piece of nature that kind of heals the land, but it's quickly followed by then birch trees and other things, and that's like a transitional thing. What we do is keep it in a permanent state of scorchedness in order to maintain heather. So you have great national parks and great tracts of wilderness still, which we don't have any of. We don't have any here. If you want to go and see nature in this country, you have to get on an aeroplane. If you want to see real wild nature, I'm taking my kids camping in northwestern Spain, in Asturias, in August for a few days, or just my two boys actually, and we'll see bears and we'll see wolves, and this is a place that's about the size of southern England, in the kind of northeastern corner of the Portuguese border. It's called Galicia, or the Picos de Europa, and then Asturias, and this whole part of Spain. This was the most impoverished land in pretty much in Europe. Really, really poor people lived there, and they ran goats typically, and sheep, and just scratched a living from really unforgiving land. And with the kind of economic progress of the 1960s and 70s, they left and went to Madrid or wherever, Bilbao, they left. And you had widespread land abandonment, and with the land abandonment came wildlife. Trees started to grow back, bears came down from the Pyrenees, wolves, and this kind of relatively empty space was rewilded naturally and has now been recolonized by people. The grandchildren of the people who left have gone back to reopen places where they lived as bed and breakfast hotels, and to train up as guide. Now I've hired a wolf guide. Probably eight different people are going to help me out in one way or another. I've got a camping guide, I've got a wolf guide, I'm going to go kayaking one day. I've got someone whose whole business revolves around taking people to swim in natural spots. So we're going to spend an afternoon swimming in a river here upon, so there's a whole industry there around amenity. And
sounds more profitable than sheep farm.
Well, I think in that part of Spain for sure. And so, in fact, the only part of rural Spain where you've got a growing economy is there. 350,000 tourists last year, and Asturias have changed the brand name of Asturias. It's now called, where you find nature's wonders or something like that. They have a sippy little catch line underneath.
Yeah.
That's what they now call themselves, the nature state kind of thing, because of this. And it was all an unintentional process. So I think something the same is going to happen in our wild places, but it'll happen intentionally rather than unintentionally.
That's terrific.
Yeah.
And do you think it'll happen in these uplands that you speak of, or in the lowlands first?
I think over the next 10 years, I think money will start to flow from the taxpayer and also from insurance companies and water companies, and we'll start paying landowners to create the landscapes that we want, because we want to reduce flooding. A pound spent here reducing flooding by planting trees will offset £14 you would have had to spend here on concrete ditches and dikes and God knows what else.
I noticed the river was quite low today when we walked.
Where were you?
The Thames, here over Westminster Bridge.
Yeah.
It's quite sort of low and brown. And
It might be tidal though.
Might be.
The tide comes in and out.
Might be. It didn't look very good. Last time I saw it, it looked a little more healthy.
Yeah.
But maybe it's just seasonal.
London is full of rivers underground, you know that?
Yeah.
All the tributaries, a lot of the Fleet Street, the Fleet River is underground in a pipe.
Really?
The Wandle and the Wandsworth.
Did you not know that?
Yeah, London. We built over them all. The what?
The F-R-R.
Yeah. Where, which part? Are you from London?
Yeah, I'm from South London.
Whereabouts?
Born and bred in Clapham.
Yeah. Hmm. My kids are really close. My older kids are in Barnes.
Yeah.
So I go to Clapham Junctions where I meet them to go anywhere.
Barnes.
Yeah, Barnes is really nice. I was there this morning. So you're in London only, or?
Yeah, we're in London for the week, and then going back to South Africa on Sunday.
So it's just you're not going to leave London at all?
I want to. Sunday we may.
Is there any cricket on
this weekend?
You're going to Henley.
There is on Thursday.
Oh, we are doing Henley, sorry.
Well, the test match.
That's right.
No, it's 2020.
Where is that? Lords?
Lords.
You should try and go and see some cricket.
Well, we are going to Henley on Friday.
What's the 20? Are you a cricket fan?
I'm going to cricket, cricket on.
Who's playing?
It's just County. It's Middlesex, Surrey.
So yeah.
Oh.
So I love that you like cricket. I wish my wife loved
cricket.
Fan.
Yeah.
Did you ever see Fire in Babylon?
I'm spoiled because
I made a film about cricket.
Yeah, I got him to do it.
So I was at a dinner hosted by David Tang, China Tang guy, and I was watching on my phone the World Cup cricket in which the Sri Lankan Slinga Malinga. Do you remember Lassie Malinga? He got 4 wickets in 4 balls against South Africa and nearly won the match at the very end for Sri Lanka. South Africa saw it at home. They called it a beaver trick, I think, 4 and 4. And I was getting all excited about this, and the guy next to me was like, I don't really get cricket, what's so exciting about this? And turns out the guy was in the business of making documentaries. And I said, you know, we should make a documentary about cricket. He said, well, what would you do? And I said, well, I'd make a film about the great West Indies cricket team of 75 to 91, the most dominant sports team in any sport in world history, really. They were undefeated for, 16 years, undefeated, an incredibly charismatic bunch, you know, guys that grew out of, a lot of them came from real poverty, and kind of coinciding with the rise of this team to dominance in cricket was the kind of rise of West Indies culture generally. They'd previously been been sort of under the kind of colonial boot, and suddenly they got their independence in the late 60s, early 70s, those islands, and suddenly there was this kind of cultural kind of upswelling. Is your family from the West Indies?
Jamaica.
Your parents, grandparents?
Parents.
Oh really? So you get this?
Yeah.
Okay, so you know more about this. I'm now speaking about something she knows much more about than I do. But suddenly there was like Bob Marley, and there was like, you know, kind of reggae music and
too.
Well, my grandmother was
was she?
Yeah.
My dad loved that film.
Yeah, see, you heard it. Anyway, so this guy, Charles Steele, sorry, I'm being long-winded, he said, it's great, let's do it. We had lunch next week with a guy called John Batsick, who won an Oscar for his film called One Day in September about the Munich Olympics.
Yeah.
And he also made a film called Once in a Lifetime about the New York Cosmos. And he made a film about that singer who was famous in South Africa but never knew it.
Rodriguez.
He made that film.
Oh, I remember that film.
Bloody good. Mr. Sugarman. So John Batsick and I teamed up with this guy, Charles Steele. We made Fire in Babylon. And I got my brother-in-law, Imran Khan, former captain of Pakistan.
Yes.
He's going to be the next prime minister in 2 weeks, by the way. And Imran called up all these guys, Viv Richards, Michael Holding, all these guys, put me in touch with them. And I'm supposed to be investing in renewables, and I spent every Wednesday evening for a year in a cutting studio in Soho, drinking beers, eating pizzas, and watching interviews with like Gordon Greenwich and things.
And then we
launched the movie in Kingston, Jamaica in I can't remember, 2011 or something.
Yeah.
And it sold a lot of DVDs. We won an award, the Grierson Award for Best Historical Documentary. Sold nearly 200,000 DVDs in a month.
Wow.
It's pretty cool. And I'm the exec producer. And it's got the best soundtrack.
Best.
Have you ever watched it?
No, I am now.
I swear to you, you will not enjoy another movie more this year. It's called Fire in Babylon.
So we covered a lot, from the life cycle of eels to solar energy to power in places like South Africa, and what Ben noticed about the environment around him and how that could improve. He said that 8 to 10 million Britons give to an environmental cause one way or the other, and gave us a very frank point of view about his stance on medical cannabis. He also produced that incredible documentary, Fire in Babylon, which I remember Ben had told us, our own Ben Karpinski had told us about just a few months before. So there's plenty of homework for anyone who's interested in Ben Goldsmith, and there's lots of really, really interesting behind-the-scenes info too.